Today is a day of dueling VIP visits and the economics thereof. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 23rd day of September. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We'll get to the Pope in just a second, but we are going to start on this Wednesday with Chinese President Xi Jinping, who took a tour of the Boeing plant up in Everett, Washington today when the company announced it has made a deal to sell 300 new planes, sticker price $38 billion American, to Chinese airlines. There is also a deal being made for Boeing to build its first factory over in China. This is, as so many things are in this global economy these days, a story about the rising Chinese middle class. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going with a look at travel as a rung on the economic ladder.
Economic mobility often translates into literal mobility.
Tourism, domestic tourism, is one of the fastest growing areas of the Chinese economy.
Nicholas Lardy is a China specialist at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The vast majority of the population is already very well fed, very well clothed. People are now spending their money on entertainment, recreation, tourism, health care, and education.
And the more the Chinese travel, the more planes the country needs. Kai Von Rumor covers aerospace for Cowen and Company.
It's the most important individual market in the world. It's about 20% of Boeing's production.
In addition to these 300 planes, Boeing will build a completion center in China, where low-skilled workers could install things like carpets or seats. Boeing's competitor, Airbus, already has facilities there. Richard Abulafia is an aviation analyst with the Thiel Group.
They're taking advantage of lower-cost labor. That's good for them. But most importantly, they're staying in the good graces of the Chinese Communist Party.
Abulafia cautions that in the past, building plants in China hasn't necessarily paid off with orders for planes. But it would be a visible sign of Boeing's commitment to the big, important Chinese market, even if much of the actual construction doesn't take place there. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
All right, over to tech news for a second. Dick Costolo stepped down as the CEO of Twitter, you might remember, back in June. Then co-founder Jack Dorsey took over as interim CEO, even though he's got another company he's running, Square, it's called, that is about to go public. And here we are, the first full day of fall, and Twitter's still without a full-time chief executive. My guess is that Twitter's board has some explaining to do and that it's going to take them more than 140 characters. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here with What's What on that. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm well, but Twitter, what the heck, man? Why is it taking so long to find somebody who can, who wants to, who will run this company?
Yeah, Twitter is stuck. And to be honest, I'm starting to wonder if it's not a little bit of denial. I think that the board and a lot of other people seem to agree that Jack Dorsey is the best option to run Twitter. He's been kind of half-timing it, running both Twitter and Square. And I think the board's a little paralyzed by his involvement. And they seem to be just hoping that he will give up and take the job. And that doesn't seem to be happening.
All right. I'll get to the Jack thing in a minute. But what is the, I guess, conventional wisdom on what Twitter needs in whoever runs this thing?
Well, that's the big problem. There is no conventional wisdom around Twitter because Twitter is just a weird company. It's a company that defies definition. So let's say you have a list of things that a CEO would need. And, you know, maybe that's a Harvard MBA, some great vision, a really solid history in an operational role, a great culture fit. That's a small group already. Then you add in trying to figure out what Twitter does. Is it a media company? Is it a tech company? Is it news? You know, Twitter hasn't been able to figure that out. I think stockholders know it and users know it. And I think that is what is making it so hard to find a CEO and why they're so stuck on Jack.
Okay, so let's get back to at Jack, if we can use his Twitter handle here. Helped found Twitter, founded Square, his payment company. If Elon Musk can run a space company and a car company, why can't Jack Dorsey run Twitter and Square at the same time?
Well, I mean, I think that's a reasonable argument, except that the board, and this is where, you know, this is where this all keeps coming back to the board. The board is not buying that. And they have specifically said in their sort of outline for what they want as they search for a CEO, that they want somebody who can give full attention to the company. And you could argue that full attention is necessary. SpaceX and Tesla are in good shape. You know, generally speaking, they're companies that are doing fine. Twitter is not in good shape. Twitter needs definition and it needs leadership. And I think it's a decent argument that you can't really do both.
What happens to Twitter if we go, what, like another 100 days without a CEO?
Then I think things start to get pretty serious. I think investors are taking a hard look at the board and whether they're being effective. I think you start to really worry about brain drain at Twitter. Yeah. You start to worry that senior leadership is going to leave. They've obviously been passed over for the CEO job. That's got to be clear to
not
everybody.
Not today. Not you, thanks. Yeah.
Sorry, buddy. You know, so anybody who is feeling a little passed over might move, might leave, and that would increase the leadership problems even more. And of course, there's the concern that advertisers might start to say, hey, maybe this isn't such a good investment after all, and then Twitter starts to lose money.
I would be totally bummed if Twitter went away, I got to tell you.
I don't think any journalist in the world wants Twitter to go away, right. But I'm not sure anybody else feels that
way. Well, yeah, which is a whole different story. Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
All right, one more CEO story before we move on. Martin Winterkorn no longer is one. He stepped down from his job running Volkswagen this morning. On Wall Street today, a whole lot of bouncing around. Got to say, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Day two of the Pope's visit to the United States is pretty much in the books, and he was busy. The White House this morning, a meeting with American bishops at lunchtime, and a canonization at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception this afternoon. There's an address to Congress tomorrow, then he's off to New York City, and then this weekend, Philadelphia, where more than a million people are expected to turn out for a papal mass on Sunday afternoon. Proving that almost everything is a business opportunity, all those pilgrims, you know, are going to need a place to lay their weary heads. From WHYY in Philadelphia, Katie Culinary reports.
When Mark Zajac's wife heard a friend of a friend got $20,000 to rent out her place the week Pope Francis comes to Philadelphia, the couple decided to list their house on Craigslist and Airbnb.
So here's the room that we use.
Zajac gives me a tour of his three-bedroom row home, just a 10-minute walk from where the Pope will celebrate a huge outdoor mass.
This is the third floor.
He shows me the large master bedroom and bathroom, and the pièce de résistance, a roof deck.
You can actually see the top of the art museum over there, and I believe that is where the Pope is going to be delivering his mass.
How much for this view? The Zajacs are asking $14,000 for the whole week in hopes of taking a vacation in the Bahamas, but no takers.
So far, we have not gotten any feedback, no.
They're not the only ones. There are about 4,100 listings on Airbnb, and just a quarter of them are booked. That's according to Beyond Pricing, a startup that helps hosts price their listings. So has Philly's papal housing bubble burst? Yes, says Beyond Pricing's Ian McHenry, who's seen this happen a lot.
Everything sells out, makes all the headlines, and everyone starts seeing people listing their places for thousands of dollars, and they think, wow, if my neighbor can list their place for that, then I can too.
The other problem? It's hard to estimate just how many people will actually show up. Let's look back at another event that brought throngs of people to an American city.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
1.8 million people traveled to Washington, D.C. to see President Obama's first inauguration in 2009. But early estimates put that number at 4 million. Hotels filled up early, and thousands of people put up entire homes and guest rooms for rent, many for more than $1,500 a night, hoping to make a quick buck. But by the time Inauguration Day rolled around, people like Tanya Odabashian, whose company specializes in short-term rentals, couldn't give their units away.
Given that the media kept, you know, going on and on and on about how impossible it was going to be to get a hotel room, I think those that might have come and been happy to pay $300 a night for an apartment were thinking, holy crap, there's no way I'm going to get a room, and didn't even try, maybe? I don't know.
In the end, the supply was much bigger than the demand. It's the same in Philadelphia, where even hotels have vacancies now. And McHenry says most people are still charging three times what they should be.
It's not a gold rush. You know, you should do it for a little extra money and for the joy of helping people out that need a place.
So if they're not paying to stay in a row house with a roof deck just a short walk from where Pope Francis will be, where exactly are papal pilgrims laying their heads? Many have found more humble accommodations in churches, museum floors, fitness clubs, and even the Philadelphia Zoo. I'm Katie Colinari for Marketplace.
These are troubled times at once mighty ESPN. The grand champion of sports television is losing millions of subscribers, all the while being on the hook to pay billions of dollars to sports leagues for the rights to air their games. That kind of math doesn't really cut it on Wall Street, hence all the talk of late that the network, which is owned by Disney, is gearing up to lay off hundreds of people. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has the story, which begins in the way that capitalism sometimes works in Fridley, Minnesota.
There's a close relationship between ESPN's agony and John Brillhart's joy. He runs his own business outside Minneapolis.
So I'm a cord-cutting consultant, and what I do is I help people get rid of cable or satellite and use other options to watch television.
And that's your entire job?
Yeah, surprisingly enough, it is.
The idea that cable uninstaller is a hot new career track says everything about why ESPN's corporate overlords are tightening belts. Cord-cutting customers are devastating. Brett Sappington directs research at Parks Associates.
Consumers are looking for content in other places, and so if your revenues are based significantly off of cable TV, then you get hit pretty hard by that.
Even if you hate sports and don't even know what channel ESPN is on, it gets your money if you have cable. Brad Adgate is with Horizon Media.
All of them are paying over $6 a month to get the network.
That's a hefty number compared to what other channels charge cable companies. But big rates don't help if cable subscribers keep disappearing. ESPN has astounding bills to pay the NFL, NBA, and others. Laura Martin is senior analyst at Needham & Company.
They have contractual obligations to meet these rising sports rights. And so the only way to cut costs is they have to cut other costs that aren't the sports rights costs. So they're cutting people.
And it'll get nastier for ESPN's legacy cable business. It's a company built on quietly collecting $6 a household, whether it watches sports or not. That's a selling point for entrepreneur John Brillhart.
A primary consumer of mine is customers that don't necessarily watch sports.
The more those folks wise up, the worse life gets for ESPN. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And, you know, Terminator isn't going to happen.
Yeah, maybe Terminator's not going to happen. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 50 points today, 50 points, 0.3%, closed at 16,279. The NASDAQ off 3 points, less than 0.1%, finished at 4,752. The S&P 500 also off 3 points, about 0.2% on that particular index, ended things at 1938. The energy sector was a drag on markets today, and coal producers were a drag on the energy sector. Arch Coal Incorporated and SunCoke Energy both off 12%. You might have seen the photos of Pope Francis getting squired about in Washington, D.C. today and yesterday, in point of fact, in a Fiat 500L. Well, shares in Fiat Chrysler bumped up 2.8% in trading in Milan. The stand-up Popemobile, the white one, is a modified Jeep, which, by the by, is also a Fiat-owned automaker. Good day for them. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.15%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. JCPenney made some news today. Another round of executive musical chairs. The recently troubled retailer has a new chief merchant. Kohl's and Target have made similar announcements lately. And I can hear you from here, right? Hey, Kai, what is a chief merchant anyway? Marketplace's Nova Sappho is on it.
Come back with me to the late 80s when Zuba pants were big. If you're about to Google Zuba pants like I did for this story, do your eyes a favor and stop. They're baggy exercise pants with zebra print. Thank goodness they're ancient history, right? Apparently not.
Yes, it's finally true. Zubas have returned after a 12-year hiatus.
Ticket pack, and you will get
A pair of these D-back Zubas pants.
A chief merchant's job is to decide whether this is a real thing or a temporary blip.
There's some risk-taking involved.
That's analyst Paul Swinand of Morningstar. He says a chief merchant is basically the chief buyer for a retail outlet, for everything from appliances to housewares to high fashion.
The chief merchant will visit boutique stores, key to spotting trends, popular things in the South for the spring, popular things in the winter, show up early in Minneapolis.
Sounds like a great job for any teen in America.
That's part of the challenge, right? You have a chief merchant who could be a bit older.
Analyst Brian Solis of Altimeter Group says there is an art to the job. A chief merchant has to live outside the corporate bubble and even outside of their own tastes and wants.
And that's really what it comes down to, is having relevant perspective to build a brand that people are just going to want.
These days, chief merchants are often competing with data crunchers looking at consumer patterns. Walmart last year decided to not even fill its vacated chief merchant position. Still, the role is important for many retailers, especially, say our analysts, during the crucial holiday shopping season. I'm Novosafo for Marketplace.
Zuba's pants, by the way, I just looked them up, $35 a whack. Go figure that out. All right, moving on. We have done a couple of stories the past month or so about fracking bans and how local governments have tried, not without legal challenges, to ban fracking. We've seen it in Pennsylvania, in Texas, and now in Colorado. The state Supreme Court there has agreed to hear a case on whether local fracking limits are okay and how much control communities have over oil rigs moving in right next door. From our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
At issue are two local restrictions on fracking. Longmont, Colorado passed a ban, and Fort Collins a five-year pause. Both were struck down and appealed to the high court. In all, communities in at least 25 states have passed some limit on fracking. Why? Law professor David Spence at the University of Texas Austin says towns bear most of the costs of fracking: air pollution, water risks, truck noise.
In the Eagle Ford Shale in South Texas, local governments have no power to tax the trucks that drive over their small local rural roads and essentially destroy them over time.
Oil and gas companies say state law trumps local restrictions, and they've often won. Thing is, this same industry comes to Washington to argue for local rules that are closer to the action. Contradiction? Hannah Wiseman teaches law at Florida State.
Any regulated actor will seek out the path of least resistance. Industry is arguing for state control because so far it's where industry has tended to find friendlier regulation.
Many energy companies have sought to raise safety standards and to cooperate with towns to acquire what some call a social license to operate. Problem is, fracking is a fragmented industry with hundreds of companies, says law professor John Nolan at Pace University.
There are a fair number of small and unsophisticated and maybe irresponsible and rogue companies. I think it's very difficult to control the entire industry.
So he won't be surprised if more frack bans and more challenges to them come along. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Computers, as we all know, are taking over more and more of our lives. To be clear, that is not necessarily a bad thing. E-commerce and social networks and search, to name just the most obvious examples, rely on machines learning more and more about what we like so that they can give us more and more of what we want. You take that to its logical extension, though, and there are a whole lot of questions to be asked about how far machines that can learn might go. Pedro Domingos examines some of those questions and has some of the answers in his new book. It's called The Master Algorithm. Pedro, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if maybe the first thing we ought to do, since in all honesty, I'm not quite clear on what algorithms are. Let's give a basic definition of terms, shall we?
Yeah, sure. An algorithm is just, you know, a set of instructions that you give to a computer. It's how you tell computers to do what you want them to do. So everything in the world that uses computer these days, and that's pretty much everything in the world, involves algorithms.
Let me then sort of cut to the chase here and get to this idea you have of the master algorithm, which, not to be pejorative at all here, but it sounds a little scary.
Well, a master algorithm is a machine learning algorithm. And what is machine learning? The computer is not programmed by a human anymore. It just learns by itself. Google uses it to choose what search results to give you. Amazon, you know, uses it to recommend products. Facebook and Twitter use it to choose posts. But it doesn't end there. There's this race going on now, right? And this is also what the master algorithm is about, between these companies to model you as best they can. You know, like how Sergey Brin says that Google wants to be the third half of your brain?
Yeah.
They do. And the interesting thing is that, well, the first two halves of your brain are in your skull, and the third one, you know, is on a server in Oregon somewhere, right?
Wow.
There's pieces of your brain, essentially, you know, in that sense, scattered all over the world right now. And I think they're going to come together, and then, you know, there will be this virtual you, you know, this avatar. You don't even know or care exactly where it is, but it's doing things on your behalf all the time, interacting with other models and so forth, just as if it was you.
So talk to me then now about practical applications in my daily life, my business life, a company's life of the master algorithm. Where does this play out, do you think?
Yeah. You know, say, you know, you're looking for a date. You know, the algorithms right now are not very good, but what's going to happen, soon is that there's going to be an algorithm you view that can go on a date with somebody else's model. And it goes on a date 1,000 times with 1,000 people. And then, you know, and then finally ranks these people by how well on average those dates went. So, and, you know, and that algorithm can do your shopping for you. It can research a new car. It can, you know, it can haggle with the car dealers, things that you would do if you had the time, but you don't.
Okay, number one, terrifying. But number two, then, how do we make sure that it's under my control?
You know, at the end of the day, as much as companies like Google and Facebook want to be the third half of your brain, I think you want that model to be under the control of a different type organization, if you will. I think it should be something like, you know, a data bank. You entrust your bank with your money. They're not going to run away with it. They know that if they lose it, you know, it's going to be bad for them.
All right, so I'm not saying this to be a smart aleck. I'm really not. But come on. This company's going to figure out a way to make some extra money by selling ads based on your model or whatever, because people, model, algorithm or not, are people.
There is always that danger. But again, you know, consider the case of your bank, right? Your bank isn't stealing money from you because it knows. I mean, people are self-interested, right? So, yes, it is human nature. But what has to happen is that their self-interest has to be aligned as much as possible with yours. And it will be if they realize that if they do that, they will suddenly lose all their business because people will be really mad at them. But I think something like this is possible and certainly better than what happens today, where this is really all essentially just happening without your control and without you even really realizing what's going on.
I promise you I am not the only person hearing this who says machine learning how to create other algorithms and goes, oh my goodness, this is the rise of the robots.
More and more things in the world today are being done by computers and by robots, and even more of them will be in the future. But that's a good thing, right? It's just the progression of automation. The critical question is, are those robots and computers under our control? And yes, I think they will stay under our control. There's a very few simple things that we can do to ensure that. And, you know, Terminator isn't going to happen.
You promise?
Yes, I promise. Okay. Unless we bring it on ourselves, right?
No, wait. You can't say yes, I promise, but then say unless.
Well, you know, it's like the apple in Eden, right? You know, if we bite the apple, then we bring it on ourselves. So, as long as we don't bite the apple, we'll be fine. But we'll see, right? At the end of the day, it's still down to us.
Pedro Dominguez is a professor of computer science at the University of Washington. His book is called The Master Algorithm, if that is really him on the other end of the line and not just a computer. I mean, we never know. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
This final note on the way out today, Yogi Berra, as you have heard by now, died last night. The Yankee Hall of Famer was 90 years old, famous, of course, for his yogiisms, both apocryphal and otherwise. Less well remembered, though, is his career as a pitchman.
Who says Yoo-hoo's just for kids? Yoo-hoo's for anyone who likes a delicious chocolate drink made with nourishing low-fat milk. Get Yoo-hoo from Iroquois Brands.
I remember that from back when I was a kid. This next one is a little bit more recent, though.
Not too close. What do you think? I got that insurance?
What insurance is that, Yogi?
Aflac. The one you really need to have. If you don't have it, that's why you need it.
Need what?
Aflac.
Man, I hate that duck. I love Yogi Berra, but I hate that duck. All righty, we got to go. The Dow off 50 points today, 50 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 3 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 also off 3 points, about 0.2% there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.